Excited Utterance, the Evidence and Proof Podcast, episode 165, Haley Stillwell, Placebo Trials. Welcome to Excited Utterance. I'm your host, Alex Nunn, from the Texas A&M University School of Law. Excited Utterance is your podcast for cutting-edge scholarship and developments in the world of evidence and proof. We bring virtual workshops to you throughout the academic year. Joining me on Excited Utterance today is Haley Stillwell, an associate professor of law at Oklahoma University. Haley and I are going to chat about her most recent paper, which is entitled Placebo Trials, a new tool to discourage wrongful convictions caused by jury error. The paper is forthcoming in the Arizona State Law Journal. Haley and I's conversation begins by looking at the legal literature, the legal landscape, if you will, surrounding wrongful convictions. What are the primary determinants of wrongful convictions, and to what extent, in particular, is the jury or the jury's deliberative processes to blame in the proliferation of wrongful convictions? Of course, though, when we're talking about jury trials and the empirical reality of what happens in the jury deliberation room, it's a bit of a question mark. We don't have access to real-world deliberation rooms to do something of a field study, and even the best mock trial studies are going to have concerns about external validity. So given those empirical difficulties, Haley proposes a new path forward. Complementing real-world studies and mock trials is potentially a third option, what Haley refers to as placebo trials. You'll hear Haley today introduce her concept of placebo trials, and then we'll chat a little bit about how placebo trials could possibly revolutionize empirical research into the jury. I'm someone who loves empirical research in particular into the jury, so of course I love this paper from Haley, and I hope you enjoy our conversation today. Haley, welcome to Excited Utterance.
Thanks so much, Alex. I enjoy listening to the show, and I am so excited for the opportunity to finally be a guest.
Well, we're definitely excited to have you on, not only because it's so great to have junior evidence scholars starting to join our cohort, but also because you have a really incredible article that I'm excited to talk about today. So your paper introduces this concept called placebo trials, which is this really cool experimental format that you think can help us combat wrongful convictions. And I cannot wait to get into our discussion of placebo trials because I really enjoyed reading about this and your proposal. But before we do that, let's give our listeners some foundation for the conversation. So we're talking today about how placebo trials can help combat wrongful convictions. But in the United States, what is exactly the wrongful conviction problem, as you call it, and why is it so difficult to remedy?
The wrongful conviction problem is basically what happens when innocent people get convicted of crimes they didn't commit. And it's not just a rare, once-in-a-while mistake. There are thousands of known exonerations in the United States, and experts estimate that tens of thousands of innocent people are still behind bars today. Our criminal justice system is supposed to protect against convicting the innocent with features like beyond a reasonable doubt standard and jury trials, but clearly those safeguards aren't working as well as they could and, in my opinion, should. Some wrongful convictions do get overturned, often thanks to DNA evidence, but many don't, especially in cases where there isn't DNA to re-examine. And not only does a wrongful conviction mean an innocent person's liberty is taken away, but also it often means the real perpetrator of the crime is still out there, free to commit more crimes.
So let me follow up on something that you touched on there, because this struck me when I was reading your article as well. And that's the causes of wrongful convictions, not on a case-by-case level, but more at a systemic level, if you will. Now, in your article, you discuss two main causes of wrongful convictions, and the first is flawed evidence. So, Haley, remind us, how does flawed evidence contribute to wrongful convictions?
Eyewitness misidentifications are actually the leading cause of wrongful conviction cases that have been overturned by DNA evidence. Witnesses might be absolutely sure about their identification of the defendant, But human memory is extremely less reliable than we like to think. Factors like stress, poor lighting, and even suggestive police lineups can cause people to mistakenly identify the wrong person. And that is such powerful evidence to a jury that it is no surprise that eyewitness misidentifications are a known cause of wrongful convictions. Another example of flawed evidence that can lead to wrongful convictions is bad forensic science. What's alarming is that we already have clear examples of forensic techniques that were once considered solid, expert-backed science, but have since been disproven. And they've led to innocent people being wrongfully convicted. Take, for example, hair follicle comparisons and bite mark analysis. For years, forensic analysts confidently testified in court that they could match a suspect's hair or bite mark to crime scene evidence with a high degree of certainty. But now, studies have shown that these methods are deeply flawed and they have been totally debunked. Both of these forensic techniques have been responsible for many wrongful convictions, sometimes sending innocent people to prison and even death row before science caught up and proved their innocence. Both of these forensic techniques have been responsible for many wrongful convictions, sometimes sending innocent people to prison and even death row before science caught up and proved their innocence. Although these examples of bad forensic science have been debunked and no longer contribute to the wrongful conviction problem, there may be other forensic techniques currently in use that seem reliable but could later be exposed as just as flawed. The problem is we won't know which forensic methods are faulty until science catches up, just like it did with hair follicle and bite mark analysis.
So that's kind of the classic category, if you will. When we all think of a wrongful conviction, we think of junk science, bite mark evidence, this evidence that is just going to lead the jury astray because the evidence itself is weak. But your paper also talks about this second type of error that also distorts outcomes at trial and can lead to wrongful convictions. And the second form of error is not premised on the reliability of the evidence, if you will, but it's instead caused by what you refer to in your paper as mere jury error. So what is jury error and how does it lead to wrongful convictions?
Jury error is a significantly overlooked cause of wrongful convictions. So in the paper, I identify a few different forms of jury error, including implicit juror biases, forbidden assumptions, juror misconduct, and strategic voting. Unlike flawed evidence, which can sometimes be re-examined later, like with DNA testing to prove someone's innocence, jury errors are much harder to catch and correct. And this is because jury deliberations are shielded by the black box of secrecy, which means that once a verdict is reached, we don't usually get to see how jurors made their decision or if they made any mistakes that can be attributed to jury error. So starting with implicit biases, jurors are supposed to be fair and impartial, but the reality is that everyone has biases, and sometimes those biases affect verdicts in ways people don't even realize. Mock jury studies show that people tend to judge those who are different from them more harshly, whether it's based on race, socioeconomic background, or even appearance. For example, one study found that simply seeing a photo of a suspect with a darker skin tone made jurors more likely to view ambiguous evidence as proof of guilt. Now, this suggests that jurors aren't always evaluating evidence in a purely objective way, but instead it seems that pre-existing biases can subtly shape how they interpret the facts of a case. The problem is that these biases often operate subconsciously, meaning jurors don't even realize they're being influenced. This makes implicit biases especially dangerous because even when jurors think they're being fair, their decisions can still be shaped by assumptions they don't recognize. Another form of jury error can occur when jurors make forbidden assumptions. The idea here is that there are certain things jurors aren't supposed to assume, but sometimes do anyway. Some examples would be jurors might assume a defendant is guilty just because they were charged and brought to trial, even though they're supposed to be presumed innocent, Or another example, if a defendant chooses not to testify, a constitutional right all defendants have under the Fifth Amendment, some jurors may nevertheless take that as a sign of guilt, even though courts explicitly instruct them not to do just that. Mock jury studies even show that defendants who don't testify are convicted at a higher rate than those who do. When jurors make these forbidden assumptions, it can distort how they evaluate the evidence, leading them to give improper weight to certain facts or even to ignore reasonable doubt altogether. This increases the risk of wrongful convictions, as verdicts are based on perceptions rather than the actual strength of the prosecution's case. An additional form of jury error that can lead to wrongful convictions is blatant juror misconduct. Jurors don't always follow the rules or the court's instructions. Some conceal explicit biases during jury selection. Other times, jurors research cases on their own, bring in outside information, or even lie to get on a jury. There have even been cases where jurors have used a Ouija board to decide a verdict or were too drunk or hungover to deliberate properly. These instances obviously came to the court's attention in the relevant cases because we know about them, but they suggest that other cases of juror misconduct may go unnoticed, concealed by the black box of secrecy, or by jurors who choose to stay silent. When misconduct, like undisclosed biases, outside research, or failure to follow jury instructions, goes undetected, it can improperly influence verdicts, distort the weighing of evidence, and ultimately lead to wrongful convictions that may never be uncovered or corrected. A final form of jury error I identify is strategic voting. Jury deliberations can be intense, and jurors sometimes change their votes just to reach a verdict, even if they actually believe the defendant should be acquitted. This is especially a problem with the unanimity rule, which requires 12 jurors to agree. Studies suggest that in some cases, jurors vote to convict even if they personally have doubt, just because they don't want to be the lone holdout or prolong deliberations. Instead of voting sincerely, they vote strategically to go along with the group. So instead of a hung jury, we get a conviction without the full jury being convinced of the defendant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, which amounts to a wrongful conviction.
Perfect. Well, let me follow up on something that you just mentioned, Haley, and that's that particularly relative to flawed evidence, jury error, it's difficult to identify. It's kind of shrouded by all the rules we have protecting jury secrecy. So given that, Haley, why don't we study juries more closely to prevent these mistakes?
The best way to understand and prevent wrongful convictions caused by jury error would be to study how jurors actually deliberate and reach decisions. But that's far easier said than done. Studying juries is extremely difficult because jury deliberations take place behind closed doors and are protected by strict secrecy rules, which means we rarely get insight into how jurors actually reach their decisions. Now, this secrecy is meant to protect the jury process, ensuring that jurors can speak freely without fear of outside influence or later scrutiny. And while this has its benefits, like promoting open discussion and finality in verdicts, it also means that errors, biases, or misconduct that occur during deliberations are almost impossible to detect, let alone correct. And because of this, most research on juries relies on mock jury studies where people pretend to be jurors or post-trial juror interviews. But the problem with mock jury studies is that mock jurors know their decisions have no real-world consequences, so they may not take the process as seriously as real jurors do. And with post-trial interviews, jurors may misremember, omit details, or even be unwilling to admit if they made assumptions or mistakes. So studying real juries is generally out of the question, and our current understanding of jury behavior is based largely on incomplete and imperfect research. While mock jury studies and post-trial interviews offer some insight into jury behavior, they fall short of capturing how jurors actually deliberate and decide cases in a real courtroom setting.
Well, that brings us then to your article's central proposal, which is this notion of placebo trials, which I found fascinating. So, Haley, what exactly are placebo trials, And how are they different from both real trials and the mock jury research that you just discussed?
Just like placebo pills, placebo trials appear to be the real thing. So jurors are summoned and selected, the prosecution and defense present their cases, a judge presides over the case and makes rulings throughout, and at the end, jurors deliberate and return a verdict. But unlike real trials, placebo trials have two distinct characteristics. First, they're not real. The defendant did not commit a crime, nor are they actually charged with one, but only the defendant, judge, and attorneys know this. Crucially, as far as jurors know, they are sitting through a real trial and must decide the fate of a real defendant. The second characteristic of placebo trials is that they are intentionally designed so that the correct verdict outcome is always not guilty, meaning the prosecution always fails to prove an element of the crime charged beyond a reasonable doubt. So in placebo trials, the defendant should always be acquitted. The power of placebo trials comes from the ability to isolate variables and study their direct impact on jury verdicts. If the objectively correct verdict outcome is an acquittal, but a variable prompts placebo trial jurors to nevertheless convict the defendant, then that variable may prompt jury error and lead to wrongful convictions. Placebo trials are superior to mock jury research because, unlike mock jury studies, placebo trials can provide firsthand jury data about whether a variable affects verdict accuracy. This is because jurors think they are sitting through a real trial and therefore believe that their verdict decision has real consequences, just as they would if they were in fact sitting through a real trial. Mock jury studies just cannot provide that kind of firsthand jury data, given the fact that participants know there are no real stakes.
So, following up on something that you mentioned about variables, you actually proposed testing several variables in these placebo trials. So can you walk us through some of the variables that you would see tested in a placebo trial and what you hope to learn from experimenting with them?
Yeah, so placebo trials can be utilized to test variables that fall into two buckets. So the first being variables that can identify factors that may prompt wrongful convictions, and the second bucket being variables that may be able to increase verdict accuracy, directly aiming to diminish or demolish the effects of jury error. So for the first bucket of variables that can identify factors that may prompt wrongful convictions, a variable that I would like to test is whether gang evidence, which seems to be extremely prejudicial to the defendant, is a likely culprit of wrongful convictions. One mock jury study found that introducing evidence that a defendant had a gang affiliation, even when it wasn't relevant to the crime, made mock jurors significantly more likely to convict. Placebo trials could test this by inserting gang evidence into a placebo trial, and if this prompted wrongful convictions, then the experiment would confirm that gang evidence creates unfair bias and may support stricter rules about when prosecutors can introduce it. Placebo trials can also test the very assumptions that underlie our evidentiary rules. Many rules of evidence are based on theoretical beliefs about how jurors interpret information, yet we don't actually know if they work as intended. For example, courts allow limiting instructions, assuming jurors can ignore inadmissible or prejudicial evidence, or could use a single piece of evidence for a permissible purpose, but not an impermissible purpose, when jurors are told to do so by the court. But placebo trials could test whether jurors really follow limiting instructions. The placebo trial variable could be, for example, evidence of the defendant's prior conviction that gets in under Rule 609 for impeachment purposes only. And if that variable were to prompt placebo trial jurors to wrongfully convict, then perhaps this rule needs to be reconsidered. The second bucket of variables that can be tested in placebo trials includes ways to potentially increase verdict accuracy and decrease the likelihood of jury error causing wrongful convictions. So pulling from research that suggests jurors may be able to be motivated to be more accurate or primed to improve performance, placebo trials could test whether certain interventions can actually make jurors better at their job, leading to fewer wrongful convictions stemming from jury error. One of my ideas is to test whether juror knowledge that placebo trials exist would make them more careful in their decision-making. So juror awareness that a conviction is certain to be the wrong outcome in the placebo case provides a strong incentive to assess the evidence in every criminal trial with care, because the juror doesn't know whether they're sitting on a real trial or a placebo trial. If juror knowledge that they could be sitting on a placebo trial proved to increase verdict accuracy in placebo trials, then courts could consider informing all jurors about placebo trials to increase verdict accuracy in real trials. Another intervention that placebo trials could test is how certain preliminary jury instructions may or may not increase verdict accuracy. Courts usually give jury instructions at the end of trial, but research suggests that jurors start forming opinions long before that. Placebo trials could test whether giving thorough preliminary instructions about the presumption of innocence or the burden of proof before trial begins helps jurors focus on the right legal standards from the outset, instead of perhaps making forbidden assumptions or viewing evidence through a biased lens. If these instructions, or even a particular articulation of these instructions, increases verdict accuracy, then courts could adopt standardized preliminary instructions as a reform.
So Haley, we started this conversation talking about wrongful convictions, and I want to end there as well. What do you see as maybe the primary benefits of placebo trials as pushing back against or trying to combat this risk or this threat of wrongful convictions?
The primary benefit of placebo trials is that they provide firsthand, scientifically controlled data on how jurors actually make decisions, something we've never had before. Right now, our legal system assumes that evidentiary rules, jury instructions, and courtroom procedures work as intended, but we have very little empirical proof to back that up. Placebo trials can fill that gap by testing whether specific factors, like evidence of the defendant's gang affiliation or prior convictions, actually push jurors toward wrongful convictions. This means we could finally start crafting evidence-based reforms that prevent these jury errors before they happen. Placebo trials also provide a method to identify jury interventions that could improve verdict accuracy, like informing jurors of the placebo trial practice itself, or utilizing specific preliminary jury instructions that could ultimately decrease the likelihood of jury error and wrongful convictions. Beyond improving jury decision-making and reducing jury error, placebo trials also offer secondary benefits that could reshape the criminal justice system in broader ways. For example, they could reduce wrongful convictions through guilty pleas, since one reason innocent defendants take plea deals is fear that a jury won't evaluate their case fairly. But if placebo trials can identify and correct the biggest weaknesses in jury decision-making, defendants may feel more confident in going to trial rather than taking a plea.
One last question for you, Haley, and it's our classic final question on Excited Utterance. What's next for the literature? Now, what type of paper would shed further light not only on wrongful convictions, but perhaps even placebo trials?
Well, a natural next step for this research is to begin actually conducting placebo trials to test the assumptions underlying our evidentiary rules and jury decision-making processes. My goal would be to use placebo trials to identify specific evidentiary rules that may contribute to wrongful convictions and determine where reforms are needed. I'd also like to use them to test jury interventions to see which methods actually improve verdict accuracy. But beyond placebo trials, I would also like to see the literature push the boundaries of how we think about wrongful convictions caused by jury error. Although these errors are particularly challenging to identify and address, that shouldn't deter scholars from exploring creative solutions. there's definitely more room for innovative thinking about how to make juries more reliable.
Haley, this has been such a cool conversation, such an awesome idea thinking about placebo trials. Thanks so much for coming on Excited Utterance.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
As I mentioned at the top of the podcast, I really enjoyed this paper from Haley. I thought it was fantastic, particularly as I fancy myself to be something of an avid consumer of the empirical literature surrounding jury studies. In fact, it wasn't so long ago, maybe 2020 or so, when I tried my hand at some empirical research myself. I don't dare call it a jury study, but you could fairly characterize it as a study into lay people's priors as they enter the courthouse every day. And that sole experience was enough to impress on me how difficult this empirical research is. Of course, the kind of empirical holy grail here, if you will, a field study at a systematic level of what actually happens within jury deliberation rooms, that's very difficult to acquire because courts are so protective of the jury and so protective of their deliberations. At the same time, as you heard Haley and I discuss today, all but the very best mock trials are going to struggle with concerns about external validity given the difficulty of replicating the gravity of an actual trial. So, somewhat paradoxically, I guess you could say, it's one of the most important areas of our entire legal system, the jury deliberation room, that we know empirically perhaps the least about. And into this landscape comes Haley and her idea for placebo trials. I love the fresh perspective that she's bringing to the empirical space, and I think it's important to do everything that we can to get more data on jury deliberations, given the import of jury deliberations within our adjudicatory regime. So, needless to say, I'm excited about this project, I'm excited about Haley's new scholarship, and I'm particularly excited for the field of evidence law. There's this new wave, this new generation of amazing evidence scholars, Haley foremost among them, joining faculties around the country, and I have to say, it's exciting to think about the evidence scholarship that will be produced in the years ahead. Support for Excited Utterance is generously provided by Vanderbilt Law School's Brandstetter Litigation and Dispute Resolution Program, as well as the Texas A&M University School of Law. The producer is Ed Chang, and the production editor is Anna Rude Morella. Additional assistance was provided by Lexi Creasy, and background music is provided by Kirsten Castle Greer, Felix Wong, and Alex Crew. I'm your host, Alex Nunn. And I hope you'll join us again next time when we take on another work in the world of evidence and proof.